Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 3rd, 2006. Today's session is entitled DNA and the Human Genome, presented by Jan Chalupnis, and number is CH-JA-2006-6. Let's listen in.
Amgen, I don't know if any of you've heard of it, it's based in Thousand Oaks, California, but I work in their Seattle. So this is kind of an introduction to DNA and genes and the genome. I'm going to talk for a couple minutes, and then we're going to see a video that explains everything that I would otherwise explain myself, but with way better visuals. And then I'll talk about a few more things, and then we're going to do an experiment. So we're going to do a little chemical reaction to make DNA fall out of solution so that everybody can see what it looks like.
So we're experimental people. You going to experiment on this?
No, you're going to do the experiment. And you don't have to do it if you don't want to. There are no harmful chemicals involved. But, you know, hands-on science is the best way to learn, more so than hearing somebody talk to you. So is everybody familiar with the acronym DNA? Yes, no? Well, not exactly, but it's kind of like the instruction books for how to make us. So it stands for deoxyribonucleic acid, which is really long, and so that's why we call it DNA, because otherwise we would never get any work done in the lab. It would take us so long to say it all the time. Do people know how DNA and genes are related? So genes are made of DNA. And I'll draw my little Venn diagram. So if this is all DNA, then this is genes. So all genes are DNA, but not all DNA is a gene. So there's a lot of DNA in between the genes, and there's a lot of work going on still to figure out what that DNA does. Sometimes it gets called junk DNA, but that's a little, you know, like we don't understand it. That doesn't mean it's junk. It might have regulatory functions that are quite important. Are people familiar with the term genome? So the genome is all the DNA that makes up a species. Okay, so the human genome is all the DNA that makes up a species. And every cell in our body, with a couple exceptions, in the nucleus contains the entire genome. So all the DNA is in there in the 23, the two pairs, or the pair of 23 chromosomes, so 46 chromosomes, that's the human genome. And it's in every single cell. And it's kind of like a set of instructions. So some instructions all cells need to do their, what are called housekeeping functions. And then other genes are only turned on in certain cells and not others, right? Because a heart muscle cell does really different things than a neuron, a nerve cell, or a skin cell, or a bone cell. So, and that's something that's not completely understood either, how cells turn on specific genes and not other genes. That's an active area of research. So this video that I'm gonna show, it'll have some technical jargon. I mean, just let it wash over you. The main message is that DNA encodes the proteins, which are the things that do things in our cells. So DNA, genes often get named as the active, an active entity, like the gene that causes cancer. Well, the gene is just the instructions. It's the protein that encodes that actually does something in your cells. And then the video will also talk a bit about the Human Genome Project, which is the project that was started to try and deduce the DNA sequence of the entire human genome, which was accomplished in 2002. Exactly 50 years after the discovery that DNA is the genetic material, which was discovered by Watson, Crick, and Franklin. Franklin doesn't usually get much credit, but she was important too. Are there a lot of light switches in this room? That's probably good.
These back here are that.
Oh, that switch back there. See, there are a lot of light switches in this room. By the end of my time here, I'll know where they all are. Okay, so I'm going to roll it.
The human genome project is a way of exploring our molecular cells. Almost all of our cells, the muscle cells that let us smile, the brain cells that perceive the humor in things, the cells of our eyes that take it all in, contain a complete set of all our genes, the genome. If we could journey inside ourselves into a cell, we would see 23 pairs of chromosomes packed into a nucleus. Each chromosome contains a long coil of DNA. If all the chromosomes were unwound, the DNA in just one of our cells would stretch 6 feet long. The DNA double helix contains 4 kinds of building blocks. An A always pairs with a T, a C with a G. DNA contains information to make every part of our bodies with its 4-letter language. Each of our thousands of genes codes for a specific part. RNA polymerase copies the information in a gene into a messenger molecule, messenger RNA. The building blocks of messenger RNA and DNA are called bases. The bases on one strand of the DNA specify the order of bases on the new strand of messenger RNA. The DNA always stays inside the nucleus, but messenger RNA travels out into the cytoplasm. There, a protein-making machine called a ribosome can read messenger RNA to make a particular protein. Every 3 bases of the messenger RNA molecule codes for an amino acid. Proteins are made of amino acids. tRNA molecules help translate the language of DNA and RNA into the language of proteins. tRNA molecules bring the right amino acids that the ribosome links together to make a protein. Proteins are the labelers. Some form structures like tendons and hair. Others perceive light, scents, and flavors, control chemical reactions, and carry messages between cells. To understand our molecular cells, scientists have read the 3 billion letters making up the DNA in the human genome. Different sets of genes interacting with complex environmental factors influence things like our looks, personalities, and risks for diseases like cancer and heart disease. A growing understanding of our genes and all they do will help us understand the complexity and the wonder of life. A simple friendship, a sunny day, our life.
We're up to here is figuring out how life works.
At a very, very fundamental level, it's a key to understanding how species.
Everyone has a genome. We are all human and it's the basis.
It is the word that means all of the DNA, all of the hereditary material of an organism.
The DNA is the script.
It's the stuff that tells one gene to make its machine in muscle cells and another gene to make its machine in brain cells.
In fact, that DNA code represents solutions evolved by life 3 billion years ago in some cases.
The human genome is essentially our shared inheritance. Bacteria have their genomes, and dogs have their genomes. their genomes, and we have our genomes.
Our DNA is almost identical with chimpanzee DNA. It's only about 2% different. Now, people probably aren't surprised that we share our genes with monkeys, but it turns out that we share about 50% of our genes with a tiny little roundworm, presumably a billion years ago or 500 million years ago. We had a common ancestor with the worms. What we learned about those genes in worms and flies and yeast, now we can translate back to humans.
So we are just another species on this planet.
We are a very small species. The entire human race traces to a population of an effective size of only about 10,000 people in Africa, perhaps 150,000 years ago.
And because we're a very new species, we ain't been around that long, we actually share most of our DNA at a remarkably identical level.
We are all 99.9% identical. Of course, 0.1% difference out of a genome of 3 billion letters means any two of us also differ in 3 million separate places in our DNA. We all think of ourselves as completely unique individuals. And at some level we are.
If you've seen identical twins, you've noticed that they look a lot alike. Well, they have exactly the same DNA between them. When you get to know them, you'll also find out that they're different in pretty significant ways.
But it's important for us to recognize how connected we are, how close we are with every other mammal, having the same sets of genes, the same body plan, how close we are with trees and funguses, which run their cells pretty much the same way we run our cells. The easiest way, the most powerful way to see this grand unity of life is to read the DNA code. It's a 3 billion letter text.
We printed out DNA sequence and put it in book. You turn the pages, and what you would see would be a funny language, where there are only 4 letters in the alphabet, A, C, G, and T. Those are the 4 bases, as we call it, of DNA. It would take many of these books stacked on top of each other, about the height of the Washington Monument, in fact, in order to represent all of those 3 billion letters that you have inside each cell of your body.
And yet, in that close, those strings, in exactly the order of the letters, lies all of the fundamental secrets, lies all the instructions that our bodies use to build themselves from a single fertilized egg, the whole Taj Mahal of our bodies.
What we have when we want to analyze a genome is a huge problem.
Well, in the mid-1980s, a few people began to imagine we might mount a carefully orchestrated attempt to read the entire sequence of the human genome.
The thought of sequencing the whole human genome was utterly outrageous when it was first proposed in 1985. People could barely sequence a couple hundred letters of DNA at a time. It took a tremendous change in technology to make that possible.
You discovered, you know, that...
So that's James Watson.
You spend your time without us.
What genomics is about is taking a global picture of all of the cell, all the DNA instructions, all the RNA readouts of the genes, all the proteins at once.
It's like, for example, mapping the continental United States. And the DNA sequence level, we certainly want building by building this whole map. We want yard by yard across the whole continent. Big picture, we divide it up, and we organize the smaller pictures relative to one another.
And again, congratulations to our colleagues in Germany and Japan.
The Human Genome Project is an international, multi-component effort to read out the instruction book for human biology, that is our genome, all of the DNA, and to understand what it's telling us.
We have built all sorts of automated robotic systems to process hundreds of thousands of samples a day.
We work with about 1,000 plates of DNA here a day, or 100,000 DNA molecules sequenced here a day.
DNA starts at one end of the process in the lab and works its way through all the way down these hallways behind me as a large fragment of DNA.
The process of sequencing is determining the sequence of all the individual units in the DNA.
As it moves down the hallway, it gets chopped up into small bits, turned into many smaller bits of DNA that work their way through all of these robotic lines to get purified and sequenced.
It is a process that has to be repeated many, many, many times because of the size of the human genome.
And eventually hit a sequencer, which will give you the fluorescent readout of every base pair in that fragment of DNA.
Whilst we can get a sequence of bases in the genome, we don't know anything yet about how the bases are organized.
We're just beginning readers right now.
We have only the faintest glimmer of what a lot of this information is really telling us.
In a sense, we have the book of human life. We can read the letters. And now we're trying to find the words and put them together into sentences.
We are making this information completely available, automatically available, nightly. It's just picked up and automatically sent to public databases.
This means that any scientist anywhere who has some idea can use this information to advance the question that they're working on. And this suddenly empowers all the brains of the planet.
So by putting it out daily, we're speeding discovery.
It's something about a big project where you've got a lot of people working, real synergism where the sum of the parts is more than the individual components.
It's giving biologists an opportunity to truly understand what's going on inside living systems and look at the parts that are actually moving inside and to understand how they are failing to work properly when they fail.
Brain
when one of the heterocharges ate,
I'll be in a position fairly soon to understand what underlies that otherwise mysterious and threatening reality that some of us are strongly defended against certain threats and others are vulnerable.
Genes in general are there for very good reasons. We'd be in bad shape without them all working together to keep us healthy.
It does rely on breathing normally.
But if there's a glitch there in a particular one, then it may not quite do its job. And then a disease may result. A certain set of illnesses, things like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia or Huntington's disease, a particular kind of misspelling, almost certainly you're going to develop the disease. But many diseases aren't like that. The variation, the misspelling in the gene increases your risk, but it's not yes or no. A misspelling is simply a way of saying, oh, you got a G there instead of a T. Or you had a GTCC there, and now it's just GCC.
We will be able to predict those things to a very high degree once we are able to go in and say, and ask the question, which versions did you inherit over as against some other person?
Now we all have these. There are no perfect specimens. We're all flawed at the DNA level. We have probably 30, 40, 50 glitches that are in places that we wish they weren't. So a lot of the focus is going to be on prevention, how you keep people from getting sick in the first place.
Then in time, therapies, medicines, etc. will come along, and it will be a great, great benefit to everyone. I think it's very hard for most people to really grasp how fundamental and how revolutionary knowledge that's coming from genetic research is in terms of the decisions that they will be making in the future.
We're not talking about
something that's distant from people. We're talking about things that are going to affect your reproduction, your health, your daily life.
You're going to get knowledge, and how do you deal with this?
When I get the chance, when I talk to people, I tell them that this information is coming and people have to know about it.
I think any kind of new knowledge is frightening until we understand it more.
We know that there have been bad experiences with people misinterpreting genetic information and using it for ill purposes in the past.
So we're engaged in a very interesting experiment. Is it in fact possible to study the ethical, legal, and social implications of a scientific revolution at the same time the scientific revolution is happening? We haven't, as a human race, had a particularly good track record there.
I think any project that has the capacity to affect so many lives, for good or for ill, has a fundamental obligation to study what is good and what is potentially wrong.
We can't be so afraid of it that we don't allow ourselves to use it to correct things that really cause undue human suffering.
What does it mean to understand the sequence of the human genome? Are we in danger of beginning to think of ourselves as marionettes that are manipulated by strands of DNA? And is this going to damage our view of ourselves as creatures of free will and spirit?
I think it should be obvious, and it isn't obvious, that we are far more than just our genes.
We're clearly a complex mixture of what our genes are telling us and what the environment does to us.
But I think as human beings, there are aspects of who we are that this sort of approach based on this chemical called DNA is probably not going to reveal the mysteries of. We won't understand a lot about human relationships. We won't understand what love means. We won't understand the aspects of us that are more spiritual and mechanical.
We've been trying to do science without even knowing the parts list, without even knowing the building blocks of the human.
But this is, I think, one of the most exciting moments in all of science, this adventure that we're on.
I'm sure 100 years from now, people will have better lives than they now do.
I have an opportunity to sit back and think about the impact that this project is going to have on science in the future. I feel very excited and very proud to be part of it.
The rate at which we advance in trying to ameliorate human suffering will now go up extremely steeply.
And the kinds of moments that are comparable in my mind are big moments in history when Copernicus and Galileo discovered that Earth was not the center of the universe. But 150 years ago, Darwin showed us our place in the animal kingdom. I think what's happening today is that we're finding out now at an internal level much more about what we really are.
This is humanity, this is Homo sapiens, this is it, this is the secret of our lives.
Okay, so DNA, this is my giant DNA model. So as I mentioned in the video, DNA, it's a double helical model, and it's made up of these things called base pairs that pair together in a certain way. A G always pairs with a C, and an A always pairs with a T. So these two strands are mirror images of each other. So when they come apart, then one of them's used to make the RNA, and then that's used for the ribosome to read and make the protein on. Okay, so it's the spelling of this DNA in the portions of the DNA that are genes that determines the structure of the protein. And so if there's a misspelling, the protein may be different. Not necessarily, though, because Sometimes a misspelling does not cause a change at all. So for instance, they used the word codon in the video, and that refers to the three-letter code. So for instance, an ATG in a gene, that's a codon, and it codes for the amino acid methionine. There are 26 amino acids, but there are lots of different, a lot more than 26 ways to make a triplet of A, T, C, or G, right? So in some cases, you have something where you have GCA, GCC, GCT, and GCG, and they may all encode the same amino acid. So sometimes, if you have, for instance, a change from a GCA to a GCC, it doesn't make any difference at the protein level. But it's still called a mutation. In the way we use the word mutation, it usually implies something bad, right? A problem. But it can cause no change at all. It can also cause a change that's actually an improvement. But the mutations that we worry about at the medical level are mutations that cause the protein to be incorrectly put together and then unable to do its job in the cell in the proper way. And then sometimes that causes a disease. So in the video, they used the metaphor of a language, a four-letter language. And I just want to elaborate on that a little bit before we get to the experimental part of the session. All right, and these are some quotes from a book called Genome, the Autobiography of a Species in 23 Chapters, because we have 23 chromosomes, by an individual named Matt Ridley. So he elaborates on this code or text kind of metaphor and says, "Whereas English books are written in words of variable length using 26 letters, genomes are written entirely in three-letter words using only four letters, A, C, G, and T, which stand for adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine. And instead of being written on flat pages, they are written on long chains of sugar and phosphate called DNA molecules to which the bases are attached as side rungs." So this black and white down the sides of the helix here represents the sugar and phosphate chain to which the bases are attached. Each chromosome is a pair of very long DNA molecules. If the genome is a book, then there are 23 chapters called chromosomes. Each chapter contains several thousand stories called genes. Each story is made up of paragraphs called exons, which are interrupted by advertisements called introns. Each paragraph is made up of words called codons. Each word is written in letters called bases. And so the genome, one of the most amazing things about genomes that they discussed in the video is that the genomes of every species on this planet are written in the same language. But they're all very different, right? So if there was a plant sitting next to me, one of those nice ferns that's growing out in the woods, it looks very different from me. But our genomes are written in the same language. So it's like if you think of, say, a chemistry textbook and a novel, both written in English. They have very different information in them. They're very different stories, but they're both written in English. It's kind of the same with genomes. They're all written in the DNA language, but the result of each genome is a very different creature. And in science, we often put a great deal of credence in the world beginning by evolution, which I don't think necessarily needs to be in conflict with Christianity. I can easily see God, the Creator, creating the universe through a more evolutionary process. And so the Big Bang Theory is kind of, there's a huge explosion, created the universe, and then there were various chemicals on our planet that came into contact with each other and began to assemble and form a DNA code and form tiny organisms that then evolved into larger organisms. All right, so using that type of metaphor or image, Matt Ridley goes on to say, he does kind of a, a different version of John 1:1, right? Which is, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being with God. All things came into being through him, and without him, not one thing came into being. So Matt Ridley writes, in the beginning was the Word being the DNA code. The Word proselytized the sea with its message, copying itself unceasingly and forever. The Word discovered how to rearrange chemicals so as to capture little eddies in the stream of entropy and make them live. The Word transformed the land surface of the planet from a dusty hell to a verdant paradise. The Word eventually blossomed and became sufficiently ingenious to build a porridgey contraption called a human brain that could discover and be aware of the Word itself. And then in another book that I recommend if you're interested in these kind of topics, called Adam, Eve, and the Genome, the Human Genome Project and Theology, the editor of this book, Susan Brooks Thistlethwaite, writes, in reference to Matt Ridley's image in the book called Genome, 21st century genetic science tells us that John 1:1 is no more than a literal description of the origin of all life. So I think it's interesting to think of us having God's Word in the nucleus of each of ourselves. Now, God's Word is obviously larger than just our genomes, and larger really than all the genomes of all creatures and organisms on the planet together. It goes beyond that to encompass non-living things as well, like rocks and air and things like that, water. But it's as if a bit of God's Word is in every species. And I think that should really make us think seriously about stewardship to the creation. You know, if the species becomes extinct, that's kind of like some of God's Word being lost to the world forever, right? That genome is gone if that creature is extinct and there aren't any more of it. So I think that's a really interesting metaphor and gives us a lot of food for thought. Another metaphor that I want to read before we do the experiment is from another book. And Adam, Eve, and the Genome, there are multiple copies in the bookstore. And I think there's one copy of this book, which is called Exploding the Gene Myth, which is written by a scientist, Ruth Hubbard, and a writer, Elijah Wald. And Ruth Hubbard uses another slightly different metaphor to talk about the genes and the genome, and she uses a cookbook metaphor. So she says, the language that geneticists use often carries considerable ideological baggage. Molecular biologists, I'm one of those, as well as the press use verbs like control, program, or determine when speaking about what genes or DNA do. These are all inappropriate because they assign far too active a role to DNA. The fact is that DNA doesn't do anything. It is a remarkably inert molecule. It just sits in our cells and waits for other molecules to interact with it. In a way, the DNA in our cells is like a cookbook. We need a cookbook if we want to make a complex dish, but it does not make the dish, nor can it determine which dish to make or whether the dish will come out right. The cook and the ingredients will determine whether and how a recipe is used, whether we end up eating soup or cake, and how the food tastes. Cookery is also an apt metaphor because it introduces an element of adaptability and flexibility. A good cook can deviate from the recipe and fudge the outcome if he or she lacks some seemingly essential ingredients or implements. Similarly, cells and organisms can compensate for genetic mistakes. Moreover, cells and organisms are the cooks in this metaphor. Many ingredients, among them genes and environmental factors, combine to produce a dish that could not have been predicted by looking at the ingredients separately. So genes are certainly important, but they're not the only part of the equation. If they're not in a cell, they're like a book sitting in a room with nobody to read it and follow the instructions. And they don't actively do things, as she states. They sit in the nucleus, and other chemicals read the DNA, transcribe it into protein, and then those proteins do things in the cell. Sometimes they stay in the nucleus, sometimes they exit the nucleus and do things in the part of the cell called the cytoplasm that's outside the nucleus. So before we do our experiment to look at DNA, does anybody have any questions or comments about the video?
When was it made?
Let's see, probably around 2002, I I think I've had it for about 5 years, maybe 2000 or 2001.
How do you recognize when you have a glitch or a misspelling? Because there's 3 billion of these spellings, and how do you know when one is a misspelling and when it's not?
Well, as we learn about genes, and so as I said, the DNA isn't all genes, but we know something about what kind of sequences precede a gene, and then we know that the beginning codon of any gene is the ATG, which encodes methionine, so that's always the first amino acid of a protein. And so there has, even before the genome, the sequence of the genome was known, people were cloning individual genes, and the sequence of those individual small bits of DNA was becoming known and deposited into databases. So in cases where a disease was traced to a specific gene, you can look at the sequence of that gene, and then you can look at the sequence of that gene from a person who doesn't have that particular problem and determine if there's a difference.
Is Amgen associated with the National Geographic DNA study?
It's a for-profit company. We do research in inflammation, oncology, metabolic disorders, a whole host of things, a lot of research at the molecular level, and with the goal of trying to produce pharmaceuticals to help people with grievous illness. Later, at the end of this week, on Friday, my topic is allocation of resources. What's the proper way to use money for healthcare? You know, is it okay to spend a ton of money on personalized medicine versus trying to make sure everybody has access to some healthcare? So if anyone's interested in that topic, you to come to that session. Okay, so, you know, what does DNA look like? We have DNA in all of our cells, except like the red blood cells that, as they develop, they enucleate, so they don't have nuclei. But we never get to see our own DNA because it's so tiny. If you strung out all the DNA in one nucleus, it would be about 6 or 7 feet long. It's so thin that you'd need an electron microscope to be able to see it. And in the lab, we have lots of other ways of seeing it, like running it on a gel. But if you have a lot of DNA in one place, you can see what it looks like. So I'll just do a quick demonstration. I've got these handouts. I don't think I have enough for everybody. No, I definitely don't have enough for everybody. But you can pass them around and try and share. I wasn't sure how many people would be coming to my session, so and I was trying not to create too much paper, recycling, waste. Okay, so each of these test tube holders has 3 tubes of DNA. All the solutions in here are all clear, but they have labels on them so that you can tell what's what. So the DNA, if you move it around, you can see it's very viscous. It's thicker than water. Because DNA is a long, stringy molecule, and when you put it into solution in water, it makes that water very gooey. All right, so there's DNA. In the small tube, there's salt. It's just basically sodium chloride, table salt in solution. And then in these other 3 test tubes that have a more watery liquid, there's ethanol, so ethyl alcohol. So what we're going to do, anyone who wants to, and you don't have to do it if you don't want to, I think there's enough for everybody if everybody wants to do it. We're going to put a little bit of salt in with this DNA, and what that does is the salt is a charged molecule, as is the DNA and the water, and it kind of crawls in between the DNA and the water. And you don't see any result by eye when you look at this, but all the little sodium ions kind of get in between the DNA and the water, and then when you add the ethanol, the alcohol, that sort of sucks the water away, and the DNA will fall out of solution, and then you'll be able to see what it looks like. So also in these test tube holders, there's a little tiny dropper, okay? And some of these guys are kind of hard to open because these are called snap cap tubes, and I snapped them down real tight so that nothing would spill between Seattle and Holden on the various cars and boats and buses that it takes to get here. Some of the ones over there, I loosened the caps on, but if you just kind of wiggle them, then you can take them off. So I'll just demonstrate, and then everyone can come up and do it. So you'll take the cap off of your DNA.
What's the source of this?
Oh, good question. I meant to say that this is salmon DNA. So it's good Pacific Northwest DNA.
And how do you isolate?
Well, you can break cells open using detergent. And then there are various purification procedures you can go through. You break open the cell, you break open the nucleus, and then you can purify out the DNA. Right, so then you'll be opening your salt solution and just sucking up a little bit in your little pipette here. And then you'll just squirt in somewhere between 5 and 10 drops. You don't have to be exact. And then recap your salt too. And then just mix. You don't have to recap this. Don't turn it upside down, because then it'll all be on the floor. But you can mix it just by wiggling it a little bit. And that'll mix the salt in there on the DNA. And then you take a tube of ethanol. Open that up.
How do you know which one is the tube of ethanol?
It'll say ethanol on it. And it has, and it's not gooey, and it has a little bit more volume than the DNA does.
They have DNA solution.
Okay. Right. So there are tubes that have an ethanol label on them. So then if you hold the DNA tube at an angle, so this is really heavy, and this alcohol is going to float on top, and you're going to pour, whereas with the salt, you only put a few drops of the salt, you're going to pour all of the ethanol into the DNA tube. And then cap it tightly. And then if you look at this interface here between the ethanol and the DNA, do you see anything there?
Yeah, I do.
So there's a little white strand of stuff coming out, and everyone can come forward and do one, or look at this tube. It's hard to pass it around to everybody. But there are little white strands coming up here, because where the ethanol is touching the DNA and salt solution, it's beginning to pull the water away, and the DNA is starting to run a solution. But there's a ton of DNA in here, like DNA for millions and millions of cells. So if I gently, and this is why you want it to be tightly capped, because if it's loosely capped, it'll still drool out the side. So if I mix it gently like this, then all the ethanol is coming into contact with the DNA and salt solution. And now, what do you see in there? There's a huge blob of white stuff. And that's all of the DNA that's in there. So when it's just a little bit of it's coming out of solution, it's very strandy. But when there's a whole bunch of it, all those strands are sticky, so they kind of stick together and make a glob. So you'll see the glob of DNA. And if we looked at our own DNA, it would look exactly like this, because it's made out of the exact same substance. Now the bases are in a different order and spell out different instructions, but it's the same substance. So DNA from us or a plant or a bacterium would look exactly the same. So if people want to come forward, there's enough for three people in each rack. There's enough ingredients for three people to do the experiment. Maybe if we open some lines, people will be able to see a little better.
Here we go.
Oh yeah, these big rafts.
Wait, what?
Some of them are used.
Okay, wait a minute. You shake it after the salt?
Yeah, just wiggle it a little bit.
Oh, wiggle
just
it.
Just wiggle it.
Not, you don't shake it. Yeah, you shake it work.
For the Human Genome Project, and it was really a couple hundred people that worked at the in the Human Genome Project. So it still doesn't even comprise the diversity that's in the entire world. And there is something called the Human Genome Diversity Project that's seeking to get samples of DNA from ethnic groups around the world that are not represented at all in the Human Genome Project.
Do we have the names of these individuals?
I don't know if they're listed anywhere.
That's interesting.
I'm not sure if they were given confidentiality for this or not, or if they had a chance to say, yes, I want my name known, or no, I don't. That's a good question. And China has their own Human Genome Project to look at all the ethnic groups within China as well. And so there are ethical questions that go along with that. You know, can you go into wherever, South America, the Amazon, Africa, and take DNA from people? Can you give them enough information so that they can make informed consent? A lot of questions like that. Are you exploiting them by taking their DNA and sequencing it? What if some useful information or interesting information comes from that? Does the scientist own that, or the institution that the scientists work for, or does the individual or the individual's ethnic group own that? There are already questions like that where people go to, mostly relating to plant DNA information, where scientists go to other regions of the world, look at plants or other animals and some of the substances they produce, and then screen those substances for use in, for instance, fighting cancer. So if they find something interesting somewhere in the world, do they owe that place any of the profits from whatever they discover? So there are a lot of issues like that, but the human genome is diverse. As is the dog genome, for instance, as you would imagine, look at all the different breeds of dogs. They're all the same species.
Well, what was the mapping of the human genome then? It just identifies the number of pairs? Or if each ethnic group is different or something?
Right, but only at 0.1% from any other group. So the vast majority of the sequence is the same.
So why wouldn't they work with just one person?
They didn't work with just one person. They worked with a couple hundred. Because those couple hundred were working on the project and easy to get DNA from. If they had to go...
But I mean, why didn't they take one person?
Because they wanted to get a little bit... Because that person would either, for one thing, be either male or female, right?
Yeah.
So you'd be missing... If they were female, you'd be missing the entire Y chromosome.
But then if you could map that, then wouldn't you map the male? And then the second one would tell you what the... It seems like if you map 200, you've got a lot of confusion there in what you're mapping, because you've got 200...
Well, you can with the power of computer... None of this would be possible without computer technology.
Right.
So the computer can take all the little bits and pieces from whichever individuals and look at homology within that sequence and line up which sequences are from the same region. But with 200 people, you at least get a little bit of sense of diversity, because not all those people are of the same race.
The fellow who did it independently, how many people did he take DNA from?
I don't know. That's a good question. So he's referring to the fact that there's the academic group, the Human Genome Project, that was doing this work, and then there was Craig Bentner and his company that figured out a faster way to do it, which the Human Genome Project people felt was a little too messy and fraught with error, perhaps, and so there was some conflict between these two groups. But the whole thing ended up getting done several years faster because it turned into a race between who would get it quicker. And in the end, they both kind of shook hands and made nice and said, you know, it was a tie. But there was friction between
was a good check and balance,
between the industrial or the company, the corporate group, and the academic group.